Welcome back to Friends Like Us. Marina Franklin here, your regular host. This week's episode is informative. We need that. We need to be informed by real news. It's a serious topic, and we go there this week with people who do the work and know the truth from the fake. Also, it's still Women's Month, and these are two women who were very instrumental in helping build the community from within. We have Reverend Wendy Calderon. She is one that was recognized by the Women's Caucus here in New York for showing great leadership that has made a positive effect. She currently serves as executive director of Bronx Connect, which is a two-tiered program that supervises mid-risk youth with delinquency matters. And we have Pamela Villa. She brought me Reverend Wendy. Pam is now working there. She's a youth empowerment coordinator at Bronx Connect. She's a new friend who, after seeing me at the Comedy Cellar, asked if I would be interested in doing a fundraiser for JLUSA, a program that is dedicated to reducing crime and cutting the U.S. prison population in half by 2030. And so the friendship began. It is perfect timing, right? As our current administration are proposing budget cuts that has its effect on our community and these programs. So I kind of go, well, what can you do? Well, listen to this episode and you find out. Oh yeah, and Erin Jackson is here. Comedian Erin Jackson, who just finished celebrating her birthday. Happy birthday, Erin. Erin always makes the show golden. I will be performing at Dr. Grin's Comedy Club in Grand Rapids, Michigan this Thursday, March 30th through April 1st. And immediately after that, on April 2nd in Fort Wayne, Indiana, as part of the Fort Wayne Comedy Festival, or the MMJ Comedy Festival. So see me there live. Thanks to all of our listeners of Friends Like Us, we're making some pretty impressive lists. So thank you. And CBS Play.it, iTunes, rate us on iTunes. That's important. Subscribe. You can email us at friendslikeuspodcast@gmail.com. Our Twitter is friendslikeus10. And we're in Spotify under Friends Like Us Podcast. But most important, tell someone you know to check us out.
Hello, ladies. So you can relax. We're comedians. Okay, we're funny people. We're going to be talking about serious things, but we're funny. This is Erin Jackson. She is also a comedian that Hello. If you do a benefit again, you should absolutely use her. So I met Pamela today. You know, we have today. Okay, let me introduce. All right. You guys are just waiting for me to be special. It's not going to happen. Pamela, I met actually while I was doing the benefit for JLUSA. USA. This is the thing. I was just saying.
She's having an leadership issue with initials today.
Yeah, Judy Gold was just stopping by, and I was like saying that we do a lot of benefits, so we get them mixed up. So I had done ALS for her, but I said it was ACLU, so I get things mixed up. So
and
just
it
so you know,
the whole story.
That's why
very
I'm a little like. But JLUSA and Pamela, she is the Youth Empowerment Network coordinator now, right at Bronx Connect, where she works with four classrooms of at-risk youth. And before that, she was a community organizer working to close Rikers Island, a notoriously corrupt and violent jail in New York City, which we all have heard stories. And you used to work in banking, too, before that.
Yes.
And then you left that to pursue a career in social justice. And
something way less stressful than banking.
Than banking, yes. Is it less stressful?
It's stressful. I would say it's just as stressful, just in a totally different way.
Right. Oh, okay. And then we also have Reverend. I say Reverend. You're
yep.
a Reverend.
Yep, I'm a Reverend.
Reverend Wendy Calderon.
Calderon.
Calderon. Oh,
but I'll take it either way.
I almost did it. Reverend Wendy Calderon. Mm-hmm. Payne has worked for Urban Youth Alliance since 1989. In 1988, Public and Private Ventures challenged the board of Urban Youth Alliance to join a faith-based initiative to gauge if churches would work with high-risk youth to help change their lives. From this challenge, Bronx Connect was born. And she serves as the executive director of Bronx Connect and has been involved with the union for over 28 years. Congratulations. That's
I know, I thought you were going to say, but Reverend Wendy, you look like you're only 35.
Oh, that was coming.
Oh, it's coming.
It was coming. Why Reverend? Like, how did you...
So, Urban Youth Alliance is actually a community-based, faith-based work. It started in 1970, like a grassroots youth organization, black and Hispanic, Asian, white, Pentecostal predominantly, but multi-denominational kids in the Bronx, Manhattan, sharing the gospel on their campuses. And then I actually came to faith in 1986. And someone asked me this recently. I was a freshman at Brown, and I was reading the Bible, and Jesus says something about if anyone has two cloaks, he should share one with someone who has none. Do the same with food. And I remember sitting there thinking, wow, if everybody followed this man's wisdom, we'd have no poverty in the world. It was like as simple as that, and that kind of started my search into Christianity. So I started working at Urban Youth Alliance, and I thought I was going to do 2 years before going back to grad school, and then I never left because I was having so much fun. And in 1998, we were challenged. They were doing a faith-based initiative. I don't know if you ever heard of Reverend Eugene Rivers and the 10-Point Coalition in Boston. At that time, they had created a coalition of pastors to address really rough kids. They basically said to the cops, take the 10%, most violent, give us the 90%, and we will mentor them. Mm-hmm. These churches agreed on 10 points of a coalition, which included mentoring, employment, everything. And for 3 years, they had no shootings in Dorchester.
Wow.
So Public Prior Adventures, which is, they do research, or they did research. They did the Big Brothers Big Sisters mentoring research. They said, is it just Eugene, who is this, like, fantastic black pastor? Like, is it him? Or is it the fact that churches are so entrenched in a community that we could actually change the outcomes of these really high-risk youth? And my board said yes. We could do it because our founder, the Reverend Faith Brown, had actually led the beginning of Urban Youth Alliance on Fox Street in the Bronx. And it was a time when Fox Street was 85% adult addicted and adult drug addicted. And it was a very, and she was a white woman, blonde hair. Yo soy colombiana, I'm Colombian. But she was like from Colorado, German descent. But she really believed that the gospel could change people's lives. And so let me say this. She got interviewed by 2020 in 1967 when she was working under another organization. And on national news, they said to her, what was the most violent thing you've ever seen in the South Bronx? And you know, I guess they all thought this white lady was going to say, like, gangs or bus or something. And she said, the most violent thing I've ever witnessed is two cops beating up a junkie.
Mm.
And if you know what a junkie is, like, defenseless.
Right.
And she was like, it was the most violent thing. On national news in 1977, she blew up the cops. Mm-hmm. And I just was, my board went back to that because the Faith had died in 1988 and said, if Faith was here, she would say, yes, give us, you know, what the community, you know, what the courts cannot handle. We'll take them. We'll love them. Will turn their lives around.
How, you know, I'm hearing you say this, and I was thinking about this as I've been reading over everything that you're both doing, and I'm from Chicago. And, you know, it depresses me to hear the news, everything that's going on there. I still have family there, but my family mostly lives, like, up, you know, like, on the north side, and I have an uncle who's a police officer, but he says it's everywhere. Don't think it's not. In Chicago, the violence is actually everywhere. How is it when you see that? How does that affect you? What do you see that's missing in Chicago? Is there, or
well,
do you see it?
In reality, I think it. I'm not from Chicago, and I'm always upset when people kind of make comments about New York City when they're not from New York City and they haven't sat and supped with us and heard our hearts. So I've been very careful not to make judgments about Chicago. Because I don't know what the community organizers are up against, and I don't know what they're working against. But I will say this. I believe in the last 10 years, we've seen a dramatic drop in crime in New York City. We've seen a dramatic drop in incarceration. We've seen a dramatic drop in violence. We've had less than 1,000 shootings in 2016, which is the lowest recorded in our history of recording shootings. So what I feel is unique and what I've actually said to people from Chicago who have asked me is I think you need to address employment because New York City has just been going through this employment boom over the last few years. And if people are employed, they're less frustrated. They're less angry. Their gangs will have less of a lure if I can feed my babies.
Right.
Do you understand?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm real careful because I hate when national people come in and tell me what's going on in New York City.
No, but
so,
I know that... Oh, go ahead.
No. I was going to ask, in terms of the success that you've seen with your program, is it comparable at all to what, you know, the program you talked about in Massachusetts? Like, have you had that kind of success, or...?
Oh, we've had actually phenomenal success. So, like, in our Cure Violence work, which is in... Police Precinct 44, we saw a 28% drop in shootings in 2016.
Wow.
That's really phenomenal. And just about four or five, I think it was 11 shootings less. But I say that was 11 less funerals, 11 mm-hmm. less heartache, 11 less times of retaliation. So overall, in our alternative to incarceration program, we did a study with a PhD research guy, and he found out that after 5 years, only 12% of our graduates were convicted of a felony crime. And I've stopped counting misdemeanors, because misdemeanors might be like carrying weed, and I kind of feel like there are too many politicians who carried weed and didn't get arrested. Mm-hmm. Too many people in our society who did that and didn't get arrested. So I don't count the misdemeanors. I count the felonies, because they come in through a felony program. I mean, that's fantastical that 88% of our kids avoided a felony conviction 5 years out of our program. So I do see we have had the same kind of success. So I would say PPV, you know, proved that it wasn't Eugene Rivers
right.
and his dynamic personality. It was the fact that community entrenched organizations have a way of speaking to the community like nobody else.
Yeah, we talked about that on the show. Like when I read this, it comes to my mind. Like every week, what can I do? You know, someone wrote to me, they're like, Marina, you're doing the podcast. That's good, but a lot of times I think, God, I need to open up, like on my block, like a room or a school, like, because I remember growing up in Chicago, I had a nanny or granny that took care. She was Muslim. She was actually Muhammad Ali's nanny originally, and she decided she wanted to do a bigger thing and help all the kids in on the block. So we all went to Granny, and Granny like gave us these lessons in life. You know, I don't know if my mom knew she was giving us all these lessons, but it was very, you know, it was a very simple way of helping community children. She did it in her house. What can like the average person do? Like someone like me who's thinking about something like this?
Well, I think the average person, like if you're from the Bronx, you're from Manhattan, you know, come and mentor with a program like mine, you know. I mean, I think you can mentor, you can invest in someone's life, and you don't know if you are that young person or that person that can change someone's life, you know. Just yesterday, one of my staff said that, you know, he had gotten into trouble as a young person. He dropped out of school, and when he decided to get his life together and get his GED, he actually met up with his old librarian who had been the mother of his childhood friend. And she was so impressed that he was trying to put his life together that she gave him the autobiography of Malcolm X. And he said that book, that one act, changed his life because he realized he had control over what he could be. And he ended up getting into a union, getting a career, and he's already retired, so he works for me part-time. But he says he carries the book around because he says when he feels a young person is ready to really contemplate his life, he gives them that book. So I think there's a thing about, well, we can mentor, but I always say we need to uphold community-based organizations. And thus, we need to uphold politicians who will uphold community-based organizations. We need to be zealous for our own. And
who are those politicians in New York?
Well, I have found that the city council today is incredible.
Okay.
I'm going to say that the city council, I feel like it's over 50% black, Asian, or Hispanic. And I have found them very open. The Speaker, Mark Viverito, is a big proponent of closing down Rikers. They are a big proponent of alternatives. The city itself is actually funding a lot of alternatives to get people off of Rikers, whether it be alternative to incarcerations. They're doing that supervised release. So this is what I was trying to get to. As a Christian, I believe my life should impact somebody else's. Mm-hmm. But I also believe that the laws of the land should be just laws, and the budgets of the land should be moral laws. So we need to fund community-based agencies. We need to fund laws that are just and righteous, you know? So like the raise the age. I always say like a 16 and a 17-year-old can't sign a contract.
Explain what that is. Explain what raise the age is.
So right now, New York City, New York State is one of two, New York State and North Carolina, one of two states that treat 16 and 17-year-olds as adults, right? And so if you get arrested at the age of 16, you are placed in an adult jail. You don't have juvenile services, which is just kind of obscene to
me,
right? Because if my child was going to a doctor's appointment on their own at the age of 16, they could get me in trouble and they could say he was a truant, right? But somehow or other, his jail thing should be considered. He can't drink at the age of 16, but he can be prosecuted as an adult. He can't vote at the age of 16. I don't even know if he can drive properly. Maybe
you're saying New York and North Carolina. That's it.
Yeah, and I only learned that by watching that Khalif Browder documentary. I didn't know that those were the only two places where that was the case, where 16-year-olds are tried as adults. But it's not only sad that that is the case because you know they can't do those other things, but seeing how in that documentary they were talking about how the youth portions of Rikers are the most violent, you know, and so my question was going to be, and I guess also I have questions for you, for both of you as well, as
if Pamela's here,
right, that's what I mean, absolutely, because I was reading about the move to move the 16 and 17 year olds out of Rikers. How does that change by moving them to a different location? Is it just the culture at Rikers that would be a problem? Because if everything that I've been reading and hearing about talks about how violent the youth offenders are. Does that change when you move to a different place?
I do. I would love to jump in because
yes,
I did some voter registration for the 18 to 21-year-old, so a slightly older population, but also just as quote-unquote violent as portrayed by the corrections officers, unions, and by the city. And so when you look at statistics, you know, maybe they're quote-unquote more violent. But when you actually meet them, right, there wasn't a single moment, and I was in probably like 20 different housing units throughout different voter registration sessions, and they were the sweetest group of men, right? Like, and I just think that that's part of the importance also of thinking about how we talk about them and realizing that they've been through a lot and maybe they have done something that's quote unquote violent, but that's because they were exposed to violence. So,
Right. No, absolutely.
And so I think that's a part of it. But in direct response to your question about treating younger people and putting them in separate housing units and separate facilities altogether, data has shown that they're way less likely to commit suicide, that they're less likely to be depressed. When you put them in their community, right, so the Bronx is more accessible than an island on the East River.
Okay. But this is like common sense, right?
Right. No, and with more access to their families and things like that. I guess my question was more, and I don't know if I'm phrasing it right, but Rikers being the problem, meaning in terms of the culture of the correctional officers and the things that were going on in terms of, like, does that have a bigger impact? So meaning removing them from that specific facility as opposed to, I don't know.
A different facility? Totally. Was it specifically Rikers?
Specifically Rikers.
Rikers has been violent, and we were just looking at the history of it since it opened in 1935 as a jail facility, which is when I think the first few buildings were opened. And so it has a long history of violence, of abuse. There's been reforms. There's been several mayoral administrations that have tried to change it in New York City, and they can never seem to get over that. And I think we were talking about it on our way over here, Reverend Wendy and I think it's because of the isolation. I think it makes it very hard to figure out what goes on in there.
Oh, because of where it is?
Because of where it
physically.
Is.
Well, it's also how to get
where
there.
Because a lot of people who are listening to this aren't just from United States. Explain that isolation.
So Rikers Island is located on the East River of Manhattan, a few miles, literally a few, like a couple miles away from LaGuardia. It might even be feet. I think it's like 500 feet. So it's right next to LaGuardia. And sometimes if you're actually flying into New York, you can see Rikers Island. Mm. And it's this doom of a place, and it looks horrible from... there's a documentary that came out recently. It's called Rikers. And it's told in solely by people that have been on the island, and they show footage of what this place looks like from the sky, and it's very depressing. And so, you know, it's this 9,000 people are housed in this island, and it has 10 different jail complexes. And it's just, I mean, I think just the sheer size of it, it's not just the isolation, it's the fact that you put 10 jails all clustered together in one place and no other purpose for that island, right, other than that. It's 400 acres of land. Wow. In the East River, and it's just been, you know, it's been around since 1935 when they started building out the island itself. It's all toxic waste, which is a whole separate issue, right? It's not environmentally sound or healthy for people, probably.
It smells. Yeah. It smells. It smells. And it smells like a garbage dump.
Mm-hmm.
So, like... Okay, so I want to ask, actually, you, Pamela, what specifically made you, what like, struck you that this is something you wanted to go into after banking? Like, you know, like, was it a story that you saw, or?
I think it's a combination of a few things. So I mentored youth in Chicago, actually.
I didn't
so
know that.
So I went to school in Chicago. I graduated 2012, and so for a couple years I started this program. It was called the Community Change Project, where we encouraged young people to come up with their own ideas to benefit their community. So they came up with a bunch of different projects, but just seeing the impact of what their daily struggles could be, right? One of them was a gang member at the age of 12 because she lost her parents and had to provide for her younger siblings, right? Like, these stories aren't the stories you hear when you hear super predator or, you know, these things we often hear in the media. And then secondly, and at the time I didn't realize it, but my best friend's father actually was incarcerated for 18 years, and she was ashamed to tell me for the first 4 years of our friendship, and we were very close. And so I think the impact of incarceration can really last beyond a generation, beyond
just her sentence. Not telling you about her father. I really wanted to ask this question. With the current administration that we have right now, right? When you talk about funding, and you just talk about, like, how is that affecting, and what are the fears that you have with what they're talking about with, you know, budget cuts and, and programs, like after-school programs, they want to take out feeding, you know, like you talk about simple things that kids, you know, need, like eating. Seems to me... to be, like, across the board, a major problem with a lot of these programs is, like, kids are just hungry. So,
like you said, it should be, it shows where your morals are. It really, really should. And this budget that was just proposed by our president definitely shows us where he is.
Well, I do think Trump is being who Trump has said he would always be.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to kind of just, I don't think he's been anything newer than he told us for the last year.
Right? So how are you, like, bracing yourself, and what are you doing to
ready? I do think that in New York City, the thing that's going to be affected most is the NYCHA budget, the public housing budget. I think that's going to be really affected, and I kind of feel like I'm waiting to see what the city leadership is going to do in response to that and how they're going to negotiate back and forth with this businessman who's now our president. But I do believe, and I've always said this, I feel like the community needs to act like nobody's going to help me but me. You know, there are actually a lot of services out there. I just said this morning to somebody, the best place to be poor is New York City. Because we really do have a lot of services. Maybe we're not doing everything.
So if you're listening, come here. Fly in now.
Well, I'm telling you, we have health care for anyone under the age of 18. Papers not needed. You know, we have, you know, there are food kitchens, right? There are, you know, there is. I find the hardest thing, though, in New York City is the housing issue. And there's a homeless issue that has to be addressed.
They've just said that in the news. Like, you can see in the subway cars, it's like someone's sleeping more than ever.
Right, more than ever. And part of the problem is when you're building, you want to attract funders to build for you. So you're going to have to do higher rate funding where they'll make more money. And then you negotiate how much of the, you know,
what percentage of the average poverty rate, and community people are saying, hey, we don't need 50%, we really need 30%, because we need people who are making $35,000 to be able to afford a house. Right, the other day somebody listed a house in Port Morris in South Bronx for $1,200 for a one bedroom. I was like, oh Jesus, thank you Jesus, I bought 15 years ago.
Right.
So in terms of how to address it, I don't really know. I don't know how it's going to do it at this moment, where we're going to get to. But I do believe the community needs to figure out how to take care of itself, because I kind of feel like the federally, we may end up getting very little from them.
So how do you, and maybe this is just a naive question, but how do you, if you live in a community that is a poor community, I don't know if that's the right word, but
low income
community, how do the people in that community help themselves without help from the outside? So okay. In what ways?
Well, so I'll give you my mom's orphan story. I won't go into the whole thing because we'll all be crying, but my mom was an orphan at a young age, right? She's two. She lost her mother and father. We're from Colombia. She ended up living with her grandparents until seven. My grandmother's dying wish was to not split up the girls, so the grandparents raised the four older girls for five more years, and the baby was sent to a cousin. At the age of seven, she was made to be a maid. Her aunt, her blood and flesh aunt, was given legal guardianship of the four girls, and she sent them all off to be maids. My mother was a seven-year-old maid. Mm-hmm. Right. But what one of the things that did is that when she came to this country, she valued anything she was given. Right? So, when she describes this situation, we're somos colombianos, we're Colombian. If you know anything about Colombia, you have a lot of different races that make up Colombia. So my brother is, like, he looks almost like indígena, like he could be a Native American. My father, if you walk behind him in Chinatown, he looks Asian. You'd never know. You'd lose him in Chinatown. My sister is blonde and blue-eyed, you know, blondish. She was born strawberry blonde. And so my mother is in our grade school, and some teacher walks up to my brother and sister. One is a blondish and one is dark, and says, oh, aren't you guys cute? You must have two different fathers.
Oh, wow.
And said this. Now, my mom was Catholic. She was a virgin when she got married. She was so offended.
Of course.
But one of the things it made her say is, I cannot trust this Board of Education to educate my kids. Every time there is an open door, I will be in it. Which was a real big cultural shift, because in South America, teachers are like gods, and you never question anything they did. But it was actually to our good fortune that that teacher made that comment, because now my mother was in their business. Mm-hmm. She didn't trust them to educate us, because she thought, if this is what you could say to me and I'm wearing a wedding ring,
right, you
know,
of you, right.
And you said it to my kids.
Right.
You didn't say it to me, you said it to my kids. Now I cannot trust you. And I kind of feel like, you know what? If your school is failing, you get together with other parents and you demand a meeting with your council member and with the superintendent.
Well, see, that's the thing, though, that I saw that was happening in Chicago, which was part of my theory about what was starting to go wrong, was there were a lot of young mothers, a lot of young parents who didn't have that in them to do that. And so I felt like even when I worked with, like I said, this in college, and I worked with young mothers, we were told to work with the mothers as well as the kids. Where is that conversation where we need to also work with these parents so that and get them involved and realize what you just said is, like, if you're not taking it upon yourselves, no one's going to care for you.
Right. And I would say that it takes people like you and me, who are a bit older, to organize them. You know, and it's difficult because New York City, you work a lot of hours. You know, you're always working. So yes. It's very difficult. And you, if you have mother and father in the house, they might be both always working, you know. But you have to get to a point of saying you cannot trust that this school is going to educate your kids. And I personally believe that in New York City we're having issues. If the schools are failing, I don't believe it's the teachers. I don't believe it's the kids. I believe it might be a lot of things. So I've begun telling parents, ask your kid what's going on in school. Engage them in an innocent conversation. So what'd you see happen? Did anyone get hit? Did anyone get bit? Did anyone get punched? Because some things are so normalized in our school that our kids aren't even telling us. But I do believe it's an issue of organizing. And for me, I was like, where are the Black Panthers? Where are the community groups?
Well, we know
groups?
What we talked about on the show, like, historically, there was a destruction of the Black Panthers from the government side. You know, so, you know, that was the beginning of the lack of community organization. So I would say that part of that is actually not our fault.
Well, right. It's right. Yeah. And I agree with you on that. So you have to actually say, hey, the government came in and destroyed my community organization. So I'm going to step back and I'm going to say, well, who's going to take care of us?
And there was a fear probably of doing that because those people were killed, right?
Yes.
Within the Black, and they were just trying to feed people.
Yes.
Right?
Right. So
yeah.
But I do believe that those of us who've gone ahead need to consider, well, how about we move into the neighborhoods that are a little bit more rough, right? Mm-hmm. How about we do like Granny did and make sure
right.
kids are welcomed
yeah.
in our house?
Because I've thought about doing that, like, just, I live in Harlem. I don't think, my block is no longer, it's like Restaurant Row now. It's getting a little bougie over there. But I've often thought, I mean, this was my dream, was to open up a space for children, for kids to just come in and read books or do what Granny did. You know, I just don't have the income for that right now. But that is my dream, actually, to do something like that. Because maybe it is happening, and like you said, like, where in Harlem, do you know of organizations in Harlem that actually does that? Or,
well, I know a lot of church organizations in Harlem who have really dynamic youth programming.
Oh, okay.
So, like, Soul Saving Station is a great place right off on 124th, and they just got a big contract from the city to develop a youth center.
Oh, great.
Out of the DA's office. And then Bethel Gospel Assembly, which is where our founder was an elder for many years, they have an amazing youth program. And so there are actually a lot of programs in the community. You just got to kind of go look for them.
Mm-hmm.
I do believe that everyone can do something, though. Because I still think back to Bobby's librarian. I don't even know if she knows what she did when she gave Bobby the book,
mm-hmm.
you know, the autobiography of Malcolm X. Like, it really changed his life. And we don't know what we might do talking to people, affirming them, speaking out. We don't know. And we have to keep on doing it. We just can't give up. But I will say this issue of, I was looking at graduation rates. My husband is, by the way, so yo soy colombiano. My husband is Caribbean. He's Antiguan. So I have three boys at home. I say I'm raising three Black boys. I know people say they're café con leche, but which is like coffee and milk. But to me, they look like you. They're
oh,
Black
yeah.
boys.
Yeah.
You know, in New York City streets, they're going to be interpreted
as
Black
boys. I look like a Black boy?
No, you look like a Black man.
I know I got a short haircut.
Yeah, no. I was actually thinking one of my kids has hair. You're a lun. But you understand what I'm saying. They're going to be interpreted in the city as Black men. And they're surrounded by Black men. And they're surrounded by strong Black men. But so one of the things I have personally done is I have surrounded them. Every professional that we employ are either Black or Hispanic. I've surrounded them with people of color so that they know that people of color can achieve. You know?
Right, yeah.
And that's actually one of the things that Bobby said to me. He said, when I was going to school, my principal was white, my dean was white, my teachers were white. The only Black person in my school was a janitor.
Mm.
You know? And he said, so I grew up thinking I could be a janitor.
Right.
So that's my thing. It's like I'm fighting for the schools that will show my kids something else. And everybody has to do that. And here, thank God they insulted my mom before I was born. Because my mom suddenly said, oh no, you will not, you know, speak down to my family. And she ended up becoming a teacher. And she would say to me, tell your families, if there's a father involved, even if they're divorced, to bring that father to parent teachers. Because teachers have this assumption that the Black and Hispanic families are falling apart. So the minute the father walks into that PT, that parent-teacher's meeting, the child gets treated differently. She
yeah.
says it's subconscious. We don't even know it. But she said the child will get treated. So I used to drag my husband to those parent-teacher's meetings. He hated them.
But I remember meeting sometimes the parents and being like, oh my God, this is where, like, you feel like you do all this stuff with the kids and then you have to start over when the parents are there.
So if you want my honest opinion, I think the drug epidemic really hurt the Black community. I just think it really destroyed a good portion of the Black community, and we're seeing the generational ramifications of it.
Oh, right.
And this is what you were saying about they actually killed some of our leaders. Like, yeah. I feel like if we really understand institutional racism, like redlining. Mm-hmm. Well, it gets me so angry when people say things like, oh, black community is lazy or they don't have as much money. And I was like, there was actual laws to keep loans from black communities so they could not build wealth. The FHA was created to build wealth in America, but they redlined black communities.
Right.
Isn't that incredible? I mean, if there isn't something so racist, so people who were working, who had income, were not allowed to buy wealth. So if the black community is poor, it's because they are 100 years behind in building wealth because it was denied them.
Not only that, it's like I do this joke on stage about like the first time we saw a ripe tomato. I think I did that on your show.
Did I do that
at your show? I said I live in Harlem. The first time I saw a ripe tomato, I was like, oh, they're coming. The white people are coming, which is a sad thing because you're talking about, like, I remember moving into Harlem. Now I'm from Chicago, so I also don't have an understanding of New York City, right? But I moved into 16th Street when it was still, like you said, very drug ridden. So I saw where there was nothing there, and like trying to get fresh produce was impossible. I had to climb. So I live on off of. I'm telling people where I live now. But I live on Frederick Douglass Boulevard, right? Which a cab driver said. I think it's important you say that because it's also 8th Avenue.
Yeah.
Frederick Douglass Boulevard. In order to get fresh produce, I would have to climb the hill up on 110th Street to go to where Columbia is, the college, to get a decent, like, vegetables.
I used to live on 141st and Lenox. Mm-hmm. I lived there for quite a few years. I roomed with a friend, and the grocery store down right there on Lenox had the worst produce. I wouldn't shop there. And I would get me so angry that they were giving crappy produce to my community.
Yeah.
And it was a big store. It wasn't a bodega. But it was just, I remember getting lettuce once, and there was something white in it. And I was like, oh, Jesus.
Yeah.
Jesus.
And people don't even, they don't know that exists. I know when I say it on stage, sometimes I'll have like a white girl go, is that really true? Like, you can't get a nice tomato? And it's like, now, but for me, it was also like a girl who grew up in Chicago in, you know, wealthy suburbs. This was also for me new.
Yeah.
To see that this was happening in New York City.
Yeah.
You know, I want to ask you, since you brought up such a good point about the parents and the children, and this week we had the story about DC and the young girls gone missing, mm-hmm. and how that went viral when it was some misunderstanding about actually what was actually going on. They were saying they were putting it out on social media more, and that's why people thought it was a news story when really it was not a news story, that these were the same amount of girls that had gone missing, reported missing. But it now, because it was on like Instagram and social media, I'm saying this right, Erin?
Well, I was just telling Marina, I'd seen Mayor Bowser from DC, which is where I came from. She was on TV yesterday and she was saying that DC has made more of a concerted effort to publicize when children go missing. Not that there's been a surge in missing children, and
right.
that even if these are children who left home voluntarily, they are not being supervised by an adult and they need to be returned somewhere. So it doesn't matter if they left home or they were taken, they need to be found and be in a safe place, even if that's not their home. So she was saying how celebrities got a hold of an image and started tweeting it out and making it into a story that wasn't quite,
but what
it wasn't
the
like
real
they were being
story was,
off the street.
Was that these were young, you know, children who were leaving home. And I wanted to ask you, how many cases of that do you see in the Bronx where is that still, where children are juvenile, do you call them juvenile delinquents? Is that a word? I feel like that's not a word that you would use, but.
So the courts call them that.
Okay.
And that's actually a blessing because then they're juveniles. They're not treated like adults.
Okay.
So, you know, and the court
until
actually,
they do something wrong.
Well, no, actually, because they're in our program in the courts is because they've done something wrong. So, and then actually I would say that the Supreme Court actually now has a juvenile court for the 16 and 17-year-olds. So they seek to treat them differently within that court. And there are programs where if you do well, your felony can be removed and you can get a youthful offender status, which is good because once you have a felony, it's like a brand for the rest of your life. So do I know about runaways? I don't think I know statistics on runaways because most of my kids are actually with their families and or with somebody. But I do know that a lot of young girls are recruited into prostitution. I do know that.
In New York City?
Oh, yeah, in New York City. They're recruited into prostitution. We have prostitution in the South Bronx at Hunts Point.
Right, right, yeah.
So, you know, there are a lot of girls. And I do think that if a girl is vulnerable and running away, they're going to be recruited. Because that's what people do. They recruit young girls into prostitution. So, so we've had young people who've been in very difficult family situations.
Can you tell me more about how you get those?
So we began Bronx Connect with the first referral from the Supreme Court. Okay. A lawyer called us and said, they're willing to give them this young man probation if you can find me a mentor. And we had started this program for high-risk youth, but we were in a school, and the real high-risk youth were getting suspended and thrown out of school. So we weren't very happy with the program we had. And so we said yes, and that's really how Bronx Connect began. So right now on Bronx Family, Supreme, and Criminal Court, and in Manhattan, Supreme and Criminal Court, lawyers, social workers, judges, even the DA can call us up and say, we have a young person who we believe will be good for your program. It's either an alternative to detention, like they're going to be with you, and so they don't have to go to Horizon, so they don't have to go to Rikers before their sentencing, or they're going to be with you. As a result, they will plead guilty to the felony but get probation with you, and then after they graduate the program, the felony will be sealed, and they'll get juvenile offender status. Mm-hmm. So we get referrals maybe from family members, from Facebook. You basically have to be predominantly eligible for that juvenile offender status, although we have a few amount of slots for people who have a second felony.
And then after that happens, what do you do with them?
So they come in, they do an intake with us, we visit their home, we kind of give them an assessment, we do a MAISI to see if there's any tendencies that we need to address. We get them social services. We have counseling on site, but we also work to get them counseling in the community. Then we look at what their interest is. So this was Reverend Faith, our founder's baby, that she really believed that young people could change their own communities. So we said, what are you interested in? So if they're interested in boxing and we have a mentor who boxes, we might send them for boxing classes. If they're interested in drama, we might be able to incorporate some of that. We really try to tailor our services according to what they need.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, do you have a stand-up comedy segment?
No, we don't.
Whenever you bring in some humor?
We're kind of humorous.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
Welcome to Friends Like Us. Marina Franklin here, your regular host. Keep listening. We're on Twitter as Friends Like Us 10. You can email me at friendslikeuspodcast@gmail.com. You can subscribe, but most important, check us out.
We love these kids. And you know what's interesting? At first, they're very tough, you know, because that's their environment, their language. They have to be tough. They'll melt with us. When somebody knows that you love them and you'll love them through the highs and the lows and you'll be with them, you'll go to the highways and the byways for them, they'll love you back.
Oh, that's true for me too.
That's true for all of us.
Yeah, like that's why I love my cat.
Because your cat will love you no matter what.
Well, this weekend you should have seen him. But go ahead.
But you know, so that's what we do. But now we do really stress a few things. When we did our 5-year study, we did see that it was 12% convicted of felonies, and I think it was 36% convicted of low-level misdemeanors, weed, jumping the turnstile. And we really felt like, okay, that was our first tier of programming. We modified it in 2012. We said we really want to focus on literacy. A lot of these kids are not reading at a fifth grade level. Wow. We want to focus on basic math, and we want to focus on employment. So in the last few years, we've had a long stress of we're going into employment, we're really trying to get them jobs. And, you know, I'd love it if they could all, at the age of 18, get their lives together and apply to Columbia and become a lawyer. But that may not be their future, and it doesn't have to be their future. I've said to people, you could get a union job and come in at entry level, and the union will take you where you want to go. And it may take 16 years, like it took my mother to get a bachelor's. But you can get there.
Right.
You know, my mother had no education in Columbia. She got her GED here, and she went into as an aide. And then she got one class. And they took her as a para. And 16 years, the union helped her pay for college, and she graduated cum laude from Brooklyn College. having no education as a child. So I always use that story with my kids, because I said, you had no excuse, honey, because you ain't never been hungry like my mama was hungry, you know? So that's the kind of programming, and so they, but we really focus on employment.
Okay. So you have, you said you have counselors that are there. You, you work to help the students get employment. So do you work, just with mentors, or do you work with a different agency to help with employment? Like, do you have any needs? What kind of organizations do you partner with? How does that work for you guys?
So we partner, because again, we're close to two decades old. We're very community strength. We partner with a slew of people. So like, we use Argus. We do.
So you're not doing, I'm just trying to understand, like, this is not just a, this is Bronx Connect, meaning you're working with a bunch of different
people.
We connect
them
everything.
To everybody. Okay. Just, we okay, really connect, because we couldn't do everything.
Right.
And nor should we. You know, we want them to know that they're, that this is their community. So we connect them to a slew of programs. And by the way, if they're 16 or 17, they have to be enrolled in school. I think it's up to 16. They have to be. But our older kids, because we go all the way up to 19 with one program and 24 with the other, we focus on employment. And sometimes it might mean, you know, it might be a transfer of school. And sometimes the kids might be, in reality, too smart for their schools. We had a young man, Gustavo, who was just ridiculously brilliant. He read Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, in 2 days.
Wow.
Michelle, I lent him the book. I thought I'd get it like 3 weeks later. He came back in 2 days. He said, that was great.
Oh!
That was great. And he ended up moving to Florida with his family, getting a GED. He got conditional probation 2 years. It was wonderful. He got his GED and he got his life together in Florida. He didn't go to school because it was boring to him, because he was so ridiculously smart. I mean, and that's, again, in many ways the school system is failing us.
Yeah.
And we need to say no more.
Yeah. See, I always found, like, with the after school program that I would do, it was called Reader's Theater Workshop. I don't think it exists anymore. It does? Oh, you've heard of it? Oh, Shannon. Hey. Well, I used to do that. I used to go into the schools after, and I would make reading in fun. But I, at first I was working with, you know, kids that were, you know, fine, you know, like kindergarten. So they, I would start with the Bumblebee song. That always got them. And then I would just ring, you know, Bill Cosby books before Bill Cosby. This is, I couldn't read those books now. But little Bill, let me tell you, those books, those that scholastic reading was very fun for the class. But I always, you know, I added theater and I made reading fun. Like, where in your program? Because I think, like, you know, like, that's why I asked about comedy. And, like, I think, like, you're right. The school system doesn't always, like, you know, some people may be going for a job, but some people may also think, like, you know, the arts is, like...
So, again, it really depends on what the young person is interested in. And we have enough flexibility in our program to plug them into a community agency if there was something that they wanted. They don't have to be in our... In our program.
You guys need a comic there, though.
Maybe we do.
Yeah.
Maybe.
That's what I'm thinking.
Winking.
Yeah.
I'm winking.
No, I'm thinking, like, that's a program that, because I have seen it really work with especially teenagers, where I used to do that, where they seem to express themselves in jokes so well.
Well, we've done leadership units where we do poetry. We teach them how to express in poetry, different types of poetry, and then we've had a big poetry slam. We've done that many years in a row. So we do have place for the arts, and also we do fun events with the kids. We try to bring them out of the Bronx to show them there is a life outside of the Bronx. So, you know, our director, she's not here, Tara Brown, she can get anything for free. She gets tickets to the Mets. I mean, she gets tickets everywhere. She's really quite...
How does she do that? Is she dressed just, really nice?
She's just got that anointing. I don't know. It's just people give us things
she's
for free.
Got that
and we
skill.
Yeah, she's got that skill.
Well, people love helping, especially with what you're doing, which is exceptional. How to change some of the perceptions that people have? We've talked about that, actually, about these young youth. I don't want to call them juvenile delinquents. It's like, for me, what's the word that I can use?
I don't know if high
at risk
or at risk users.
At risk. You might be high risk. So can
better.
I say something about the perceptions? Because this has come up before. When we were looking at the history of Rikers, when Commissioner Horn was trying to get into neighborhood jails, people were protesting, people in the community, not in my backyard. And I tell people, Rikers is in our backyard. Because in our backyard of the Bronx are people who have been harmed by Rikers. And that harm has affected their heads. And if you look at the Kalief Browder documentary, he goes into Rikers a kid. Mm-hmm. He comes out somebody who's talking about demons in his head. Yeah. He was seriously mentally abused at Rikers. Right. And he now, when he lived, he was living in our backyard. So I'm pushing, you know, Brooklyn has the Brooklyn House of Detention. It is a 10-minute walk from the courts to this Brooklyn House of Detention, which means it's accessible by family, it's right. accessible by loved ones, and it's accessible by your lawyer. Because these public defenders have hundreds of cases, and if you're making them drive 3 hours to get to your court, then God forbid they got busted up by somebody that you can't see them immediately. So I kind of feel like, why does Brooklyn get to have a house of detention when the Bronx doesn't? Mm. And I completely disagree with spending $180 million to renovate Horizons, which is the juvenile detention place in the Bronx, and then you're going to have to take those kids and ship them to Brooklyn for 3 years. So now the 14 and 15-year-olds are going to be far away from their parents also. Why not just build a smaller jail, like after the model of the Brooklyn House of Detention, right next to the courts in the Bronx? The Brooklyn House of Detention is around multi-million-dollar properties, and no one complains. They don't like the parking. Okay, we'll envision more parking in the Bronx. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we're investing all this money. It is my backyard. These kids are my backyard. And I've always said to community districts, you should be fighting that if you're going to build something in your community, that half the jobs go to your community and not the janitorial jobs. How about the management jobs that pay over $50,000 a year? There's a lot of money in this reinvestment.
Is that the community just unaware of that it is a reinvestment? Because doesn't the community, like you said, we don't want this in our neighborhood. We want it in other neighborhoods. We don't want it here.
Well, I feel like maybe the community has not seen a really wonderful model, and I think we should kind of highlight that Brooklyn House of Detention model. It houses 800 men, or men and women, I don't know, but it's 800 adults. You know, I think we should highlight a really productive model that has brought jobs to the community, that is not an eyesore, that places people closer. And they've actually done studies where they said that if the people who are detained or incarcerated are closer to their families, they do better when they get out. And then it also should be noted that 80% of people in Rikers are there, or 79%,
before
being found guilty.
Yeah, before even trial.
It's ridiculous. Right. So the issue of being innocent until proven guilty, or being having a right to a speedy trial, is just not known in New York. So I always say, like, you're not even guilty. And I don't know if they did this, if they talked about this in the Khalif thing, but somebody was telling me, one of my staff who had spent time in Rikers said, they'll strip you down to your underwear and make you stand like this, with your hands up in your head. You can't look anywhere else but forward, and your toe is touching their heel. But the inmates don't call it that. They say one part of their body is touching the other part's ass. Excuse me.
Mm-hmm. No, yeah, you can do whatever.
Yeah,
I just thought because you were a reverend.
I'm the reverend.
So the reverend, yes. We were saying, we can't curse it in. Reverend's here.
That's okay. I just need to make sure I'm not cursing. But this makes me so angry that you would abuse a 16-year-old like that. And I said this to Pamela. I said, if I did that to my three boys and someone found out about it, they could call ACS on me.
Right.
If I punished my boys like that.
Right.
No.
What a humiliating thing to do to even a convicted criminal. Somebody who's not even convicted.
Right, not convicted. So many of them, and we've been hearing about this for years, but so many of them are theirs primarily because they couldn't make bail. Their families couldn't make bail. Dealing with 16-year-olds and 17-year-olds who haven't even fully developed their brains, and they're being treated like, you know, grown. So, I mean, just so many offenses, and so, it's inhumane, and
they
go in children.
Right. It's immoral.
They go in children they spend more time there waiting for a trial than they would if they had been convicted of the crime that they were put there for. You know, so I guess.
And we're spending $209,000 a year. So Khalif Browder costs the city over $500,000.
Right.
He comes back terribly harmed to the point of suicidal for a $25 backpack that they threw out the charge because there was not enough evidence. 3 years, $500,000.
It says here in 2010, New York State spent $266,000 on each incarcerated young adult, according to the Office of Children and Family Services. the state agency overseeing adoptions, abandonment, and juvenile justice. In comparison, New York City's Department of Education spent on an average $18,500 per student that same year. That's a ratio of about 14 to 1.
It's incredible to me. And again, if we were not putting people in there, like if we addressed this bail system, the city has launched a supervised release, which they are expanding because it's been successful. That's great. But if we were to knock out that 80%, then there would only be 2,000 people at Rikers, which we could easily address in community jails, which could create jobs for the community and put kids and adults, because adults also need to be near their lawyers. Mm-hmm. They should have a right to legal representation. This is New York. We are progressive New York City. We can do this. This is not rocket science. It's not that difficult.
So how do you, because in the past year, Bloomberg has made some changes, right?
Or de Blasio.
Did I say Bloomberg? I meant de Blasio. I guess they're kind of the same. Maybe that's why I made that Freudian slip. But how do you feel about de Blasio? How's he doing? I guess that's it at all with my slip, but has he made a difference in the past year? Especially after, you know, the Khalees story going out in New York Times, I think, changed the perception that a lot of people had, you know, and it opened the eyes, you know, celebrities got involved, Jay-Z was, you know, put, you know, but there's more stories like this.
So I will say that, you know, a budget is a moral document. And de Blasio's administration has really sought to fund alternatives and sought to get people off of Rikers. I just believe that he has the capacity to go further and have a plan to close down Rikers. I don't think we need it. I think there's too much of a culture of destruction and impunity of any kind of wrongdoing. It's too much. I think it's kind of like when they had to completely reassess how they were dealing with mentally ill people, how they were treating people in asylums. They had to kind of just completely overhaul the system. So I feel that, yes, there is a lot of money that has gone into issues that this city is facing. The city is a very rich city right now. We have a lot of tourism. We have a lot of taxes. We have a lot of building. So I give him kudos for that. But I believe he has the strength to do even more. I believe he can do it. I believe he can negotiate a way to shut down Rikers over the next few years.
And where do those people go now? You said rebuild, restructure?
Oh, go ahead. Sorry. So, yeah, I think that's a great question, and I would agree that it's within reach. And not only that, but if you look at it in a longer, and that's the problem, right? Politicians often don't have longer-term horizons in terms of, you know, their interest appetite. But if you look at it in a couple decades, it would pay itself off because Rikers is so expensive to upkeep. And the way that the buildings were built, which many of them are decades old, even the Commissioner of Corrections has come out and said that it's not efficient. You need more personnel, which is why you see the quote-unquote inmate population decreased. And literally, you can juxtapose an inverse line on a graph with costs, and they're inversely related, right? And so you see less people on the island, and yet it's getting more expensive. And so, you know, if you think about how to restructure that, I actually think the city could save a lot of money in the long term. And in addition to that, I think that there would be state-level legislation that would have to come into effect. So there's bail reform, which we've mentioned. I was reading recently New Mexico in November on their ballot had it was basically passed that if you can't afford bail, you're eligible for bail, you don't pose a threat to your community, you shouldn't be held pretrial, right? I think we definitely need to move towards a system where we're not criminalizing poverty. Aside from bail reform, speedy trial is another huge issue where we could reduce the population by, say, 1,000 to 2,000 people just from that. And so it is, I think it's, there's a lot of things that would have to come into effect, but I think that it's doable and we need to push for it. And, you know, you're asking what people can do. And we're bombarded, you know, with things for people to do right now. Call your senator about this. Call, you know, there's a lot of hot issues right now. But mass incarceration has been around since the 60s, since the 70s, and it's not going to go away. As citizens, we have to call upon our politicians to do something and let them know that we care and that our taxpayer dollars are going to fund the horrors. I work with people that were, in my prior job, I worked with people that had been on Rikers for several years, and one of my closest members calls it the Abu Ghraib of New York. Mm. And I think that that's just brilliant because that is what it is, and a lot of New Yorkers just don't know about it. Thankfully, it's starting to come out.
What companies make money off of Rikers?
I don't know what the private contractor is. There's, that's also, so, you know, the private, the encroachment of the private industry into prisons is troubling, but for the most part, it's government. Like, the government really runs the whole thing. And, you know, it's important to push for non-privatization, and no one should be benefiting privately from, I think, incarceration. Mm-hmm. But I think it's a city-run jail. And so I think that there's probably some contractors that are private, but...
So here's a question. I hope it's not off topic, but it's something I've been thinking about.
No,
quickly,
please
if you don't
do.
Mind. Because you were talking about speedy trial being a big problem with the incarceration rate, and I just was thinking, you know, if we're talking about criminalizing poverty and people who can't make bail and speedy trial, but most of them have public defenders who have stacks and stacks and stacks of cases, then wouldn't you? Do you think that? The mayor's focus, because he kind of carried it over on like that, you know, broken windows policing, do all these, all the little things that people are being arrested for, which is contributing to the load that these public defenders have, which is contributing to the inability for people to receive a speedy trial. I feel like it starts there as well, right? It's just not the prison system, but it would need to be the entire way that policing is handled. Or no? Does that make sense? Does that sound...
I would agree. I think policing is another, you know, crime has decreased as, you know, I think by 76% in the last 20 years. And yet I don't think that the police...
You mean the stop and frisk? Is that what you're talking about?
Essentially, programs like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I
so
think
we're not using stop and frisk.
Right. That's what I mean, not
down.
Stop and frisk.
But. So actually, that they showed that... That you could keep crime down, even though I think 95% of stops and frisks have been 95% down, and yet we had a stellar record last year of less than 1,000 shootings. Our crime has gone down. So, but I do believe that the broken window policy is still on. I kind of feel that people get a lot of tickets, and even like this might be, but I always say that people who don't have papers, right, in this country, in this state. If New York State, being the progressive state that we are, you know, if we gave an avenue for people with no papers to get a driver's license, then that would drop a lot of tickets. But of course, that would also drop a lot
revenue.
Of revenue.
Absolutely.
So there's a monetary issue here. But just some stats. New York City, it's 112,000 per Scott Stringer's report to house somebody here. I thought it was 209, but...
Yeah, that doesn't include, like, overhead, fringe, a bunch of other costs.
And overhead, and overtime. So, right. But Chinatown is 55,000. So my question is, what is it about New York City? And I think a council member came out with a Daily News report about why he starts... I don't remember the guy's name, but it was just a few days ago about why he's supporting the close of Rikers. But he said that we spend $300 million a year... employing the people who need to drive the folks from Rikers to their courts.
I just read that.
And I just thought, you see, this is what I mean. Like, even the public defenders who are working so hard, but you're making them travel so much.
And then I was reading these stories about the travel and people dying, the inmates dying on the with this. It's like they're not being taken care of.
I just think that community, something in my community, let them have access to their parents and let them have access to their family, let them have access to their lawyers. That should make sense. And I always say, why does Brooklyn get it? Why can't the Bronx have it? Why can't Staten Island have it?
Why are they not looking at the numbers? What's happening where people are ignoring the facts?
I don't know. Are they ignoring the facts? I think if they were, I don't know if they're ignoring the facts, because I think the Close Rikers cry is getting louder and louder. And then we have celebrities. But I do think there are forces that be that want to keep the jobs that Rikers creates.
But if it's more money and it's not creating money that's coming back into the, why would they? It just seems like they have misinformation.
No, I don't think so. I think they have information. Oh, and okay. We will say that this is also a New York State thing. Uh-huh. Because when they did the whole close to home, there were entire communities in upstate New York that they had to kind of convince to, because the entire communities upstate, their tax system was built around these jails. This is where people are employed by. But I always say we have to find a better industry than employing people off the backs of my kids, because then it's slavery all over again. Right. So I think there are so many people getting money from
like
the system.
Who's getting the money? Yeah, is not. It's who is it going to? Who is it benefiting? It's not benefiting, like you said.
It's not benefiting the kids. Right. The kids are not learning, and then you know they're not learning. We're not breaking this cycle of incarceration. It's not working. Let's say this: alternatives work. Alternatives can work for anywhere from $7,000 to $20,000 a year, as opposed to $209,000 at Rikers. Right. I mean, that's ridiculous. Yeah. You know, why are we thinking about building a? How big is this? He wants to build something on Rikers Island.
Well, I see here. I got from an article: under intense pressure to improve conditions in the jail complex on Rikers, the administration of Mayor Bill de Blasio has developed a plan to move 16 and 17-year-olds to a dedicated jail for the youths in the Bronx.
Right. So that's what I'm saying is they want to spend $150 million to renovate Horizons because under land use, it's a juvenile facility. They now need to make it an adult facility because the 16 and 17-year-olds are considered adults. But my problem is, why would you spend $150 million when you could fund alternatives, when you could build a smaller adult jail and not take the 14 and 15-year-olds all the way to Crossroads? Those are real kids in there. And then you're going to disrupt their families.
Right.
Why not just build a small facility in right next to the courts? You know how that would change how these young men and women are being defended by their lawyers if their lawyer could walk 10 minutes to them?
It's just simple stuff.
It's simple. To me, it's common sense. Sometimes I wonder why people don't see it.
Well, look at our administration right now. They don't see anything.
Yeah, but he's not progressive.
Right.
That's my problem. Yeah. I didn't expect anything other from him.
Right.
You know, he is who he said he is. I want my progressive New York City to be progressive.
It's still very scary, though. That's the thing. It is scary. I want to ask you about, like, you told me one good story about the young man who was very bright. What is, like, is that the story for you that just stood out? What are some stories from both of you that were just amazing about the youth that you work with?
Well, I've only been at Bronx Connect for a week.
Oh, it's just been a week.
In the short week, I've seen a lot of comedic potential, actually.
Really?
The kids are hilarious. I would love, we can talk more, maybe we could do, you know, something where I work with middle school and high school kids, and the middle school kids in particular, they found out my name is Pam, so they're like, Miss Pam, what's up? And then they started being bad, and they were like, but you'll let it slide, right? Like, Pam, the cooking spray. And I was just like, well, that is hilarious. Like, how did you come up with that? And
yeah.
Then another one, this is actually embarrassing for me. I sweat a lot, so I get pit stains, and one of the kids noticed, and she's like, Pam, you have a puddle. And she looked so concerned. and I just couldn't help but start laughing. It was so funny. They're funny.
Change your deodorant.
No, nothing. I've heard apparently Botox.
My girlfriend does that.
But it's too expensive.
Yeah.
Miss Pam got a puddle.
They're gonna start calling you Puddle Pam,
and then that'll be bullying.
Yeah,
bullying.
Yeah.
And then what about for you? What are some
else? So you know, I've been doing this for 20 years, mm-hmm. and it's always wonderful to have somebody come back or have somebody stop me on the street and say, "Wendy, you remember me? I'm doing well." But one young man came back, and he came back to the neighborhood to visit family. And he said, I stopped by because I wanted to see how you're doing. And we had him greet our young men who were in the program that he was in. And he told him, he said, you know why I left the gangs? Because when I went to Rikers, only one person came to visit me. None of my gang brothers did. The only person who came to visit me was my mom. So for my mom and my daughter, I left the gangs because I didn't want my mom to cry anymore. And I always tell parents, no matter how much they curse you out, how much they yell at you, never underestimate the power that you have, because when they were born, you were there. And he actually, he was in Providence, and he got a job as a mechanic. And he was living a simple life. He was living a happy life. But I always say he came back to say thank you. But the best part of it is that he was one of my staff's kids. And she said, Wendy, that kid was so tough. And she's tough also. She was a tough woman.
Well, just
also
the fact that he said, how are you doing, is like, that's so courteous. That's something that you gave him. Just to ask, how are you?
Oh, well, let me say this. I don't know. I think his mama gave it to him. Okay. I won't take credit for that.
Okay.
But I do believe that in his very difficult time, when he was involved in the gang and his life was falling apart and he was lashing out at my staff and cursing her
That's
out.
That's what I was going to ask. How was he during
he
the program?
He cursed her out. Yeah. She actually said, she chuckled. She said, I thought he was going to jump me. I got up and I said, you're going to jump me, we're going to fight. Maybe I shouldn't say that publicly. But she was like, with our young people, you can't act like you're afraid of them.
Right.
Because then they may jump you, right? No. Maybe. They, you know. They,
well, it's not an easy job, though.
Right. It's not an easy job. But having said that, she worked with him through difficult times. She didn't call the, she didn't say, you know, she didn't report an incident. She said, we're going to do this. You're going to be back tomorrow. You know, we're going to get through this. And he got through it. He was a difficult kid, but she saw a potential in him that he couldn't see in himself. And I guarantee you his mama saw it in him.
Mm-hmm.
Because if a mama didn't see him, she wouldn't have gone through the strip shirts in Rikers to see this boy. You understand? So I never discount a family. I know a lot of times we get frustrated with families, but whenever I have a very difficult family, I always think, who crapped on them?
Right.
If you want to crap on everyone else, it's because somebody treated you badly. So how can I bring some healing into your life also?
You know? You said his mother works for you?
No, his mother, no, his is that he said that the reason, no.
You said mother, one of my staff's kids. Oh, one of your staff's.
This young man was in my staff's caseload.
Okay.
Now, because it is, like I said, a difficult job, like a lot of people may think, I want to be a part, but I don't know if I'm built for this. What do you say to that person?
You might not be.
Yeah.
No, really.
So do they? Yeah.
So okay. I mean, I'll be honest.
Because
you
are tough. I can see. I you know.
Yeah, I am tough.
Yeah.
So I'll walk into a room, and I'm smaller than everyone. Well, no, Pamela's smaller than me, but I'm smaller. But I'll introduce myself. I say I'm the big dog. I sign everyone's check. I'm your boss's boss's boss. Are they treating you well? You get enough food?
Oh, kids,
you know?
Respect that.
Oh, they love food. You know, I always try to get them more food. Remember Wendy coming, or some more food, you know. So people, because they're hungry. They're hungry after school, and they're teenagers. They'll eat and eat and eat and eat. But so you may not be. And what I'm saying is, like, oh, I hope I don't offend anyone. I don't know if you know this. I went to Brown University, and I went to a very good school. And I'm glad with people who've gone to really good schools. But most of my staff, they've gone to CUNY, and they're amazing. I've said this. I have never met a John Jay graduate I didn't like in my employment. I've employed quite a few. You have a John Jay resume, you will highlight to me. And I remember somebody was trying to get me to do this internship. I don't remember what school. Maybe it was a Princeton internship. And I looked at this and I said, well, I could hire this Princeton guy for, you know, a certain amount of money, and they'll write a blog about it and maybe become famous. Or I can hire someone from my community for the same amount of money, because the Princeton guy was a deal. It was a quote deal financially. But they'll feed their kids. They'll live in my community, and they'll prove to the people in their neighborhood that righteous employment is beneficial. I think this will be better for me, my kid, for my guy, for my community. So, because sometimes I get really excited about these internships, you know, and then I say, you know, maybe the community is better. So not everyone belongs in here. If you're coming in here to save my kids, I don't need no savior mentality. There was one savior, Jesus. I don't need you to save us. I need us to help them address the issues in their lives so they can turn and see that within them they have strength to change their lives. They can say no to that which is not good for them. So not everyone belongs with me.
Right.
Because you won't tolerate me because I'll call it out if you're looking at me like you need to save my community.
Oh, you've done that?
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm a Christian, so I'll get national organizations coming in who want to help us. No, you don't want to help us. You want to use us as a story to fundraise.
It's interesting that you bring that, because the article that Chewy sent me, Chewy, that was you, right? That sent me that article?
About how faith-based organizations
should religious organizations step up. This is a recent article.
Oh,
it says, Shannon, thank you. Shannon, she's our intern.
Hi.
She's
not from the community, but she's doing a great job.
But we love her.
But it's more than posturing. If government steps back, religious organizations may need to step up. Much of the infrastructure and money involved in the charitable provision of social services is associated with religion, whether it's a synagogue's homeless sheltering program or a large aid organization such as Catholic Relief Services. So this is the...
So I'll give you my two cents.
Are they going to be overwhelmed?
So I'm going to tell you right off, they will be overwhelmed.
Yeah, they can't pick up all that
stuff. They can't pick it all up. Now, community-based agencies should be like, what do you say, call her Nana's house? Nana?
Yeah,
Grandma's
like
house?
Granny's.
It's going to be called...
Oh, you're
Granny's house. Granny Franklin's house.
But you understand, like, you know what? Community-based agencies should be doing, like, Granny Franklin's house.
Yeah.
I completely believe that. But the truth is, in New York City, I would say 90% of the churches do not have full-time paid staff. Mm-hmm. They are laid leaders. Lay leaders, meaning they're leaders who might be a bus driver.
Mm-hmm.
They might work a secular job somewhere.
Even and the then pastors.
That's all the pastors.
Yeah.
The pastors. See, I know the black church.
Right.
The majority of churches of community-based, maybe not the mainline churches, the community-based churches, do not even, let me be quite blunt. I employ, I think, three social workers. They don't have money for one social worker. They don't even have money for a youth pastor. How are they going to address the high-level needs of my kids? Now, can they create community programs? Yes. Can they have a Saturday tutoring program? Yes. Can they have an after-school feeding program with some of the
retirees? But they can't be the Department of Education.
Hallelujah. Exactly. And I'm going to say that I think it's unacceptable. And I've challenged even, you know, predominantly white denominations who feel that they're going to come in. I don't even think it's our responsibility. We need to demand that the government is moral with its money. We can step up. So the Black and Hispanic Church of the South Bronx stepped up and helped create the Bronx Connect. But it wasn't like out of their own budgets that they employed social workers or case managers. I mean, case managers have a caseload of 20 people. I mean, teachers in schools have 32 kids in the class.
Mm-hmm.
So I agree that community should step up, but I also agree that we have to hold the government accountable to our tax dollars. And there are tax dollars, and unless they are dropping my taxes by 50%, they don't have a right to take all that stuff out.
All right. Let's see. So I want to congratulate you. Seriously, because you are, like, this is Women's Month, right? And you just recently were honored?
I was honored by City Council as a woman of distinction, Council Member Gibson.
Yay!
It was great. It was nice. It was a nice event. And it really made me remember that the most influential person in my life, aside from Jesus, which was a supernatural intervention, was my mother. And I told her on the phone, she lives in Florida, I said, Mom, I talked about you publicly today. I talked about how you meant so much to me, and I think I tell my mother's story to any young person who will listen, because I really feel that that our generation of today does not understand the civil rights struggle. They have no conception of water hoses or dogs.
Oh, I agree.
Or the fight. And in fact, when the movie The Help came out, I gave it to my nephew, and I said, your grandmother and my mother were maids. You need to see this. Why does it matter to me? Because you need to know how much they struggled and how you cannot take education for granted, you know? So I am my mother's daughter. I had to achieve because she suffered. I had to value food. Somebody said, Mama never throws anything out in the house. I'll have leftover nights. No, we ain't cooking anything new. We're going to eat everything leftover. You know, I'll have it. You know, I think Kennedy said President Kennedy used to have cereal one night out of the week, and they would take that money that they would buy in meat and give it to missions to feed poor children.
Mm.
My kids love cereal, though. But I do things like that.
What about for you, Pamela, for Women's Month? How about what woman in your life that you honor?
I would have to say my mother as well. She was always there for me. She didn't have a full-time job, and so she spent and I appreciate that. I don't know how people could, I mean, I don't have children of my own now, but I don't know how I could just put everything away and just, you know, and it's a privilege as well, and, you know, there's that, but I love working, I love going, you know, doing my thing every day, And so for her to have just given up, she actually got a law degree in Mexican University and just gave it all up.
Yeah, because you're, what's your ethnicity again?
Mexican.
Yeah, just so, because it's a women of color thing. You know, when she was talking to me about coming on the podcast, I was like, it is women of color, and here's my ignorance. She was like, I am Mexican. And I'm looking at her, I'm like, you are. But yeah, you know what? The mothers are, oftentimes, I don't mention my mother when I celebrate, but when I think back at everything she had to do, and at the age that she did, my mom had me at 18, right? And then by 28, had her third child. At 28, I think I was just like, what do I want to do?
Right. Yeah, you know, I'm there.
You know, it's definitely a different generation, you know, that is coming up now. So what about you, Erin? Is there a woman in your life that you... You don't have to say your mother. I mean, mother.
I feel bad if
one.
I don't say my mother. She'll be listening.
I mean, that's a given. Let's just say that's a given. But if there's another woman that you would say that left a mark, I mean, mine was also Granny. I remember Granny stopping me because I grew up in the suburbs of Chicago, Highland Park. Until I was 9, you know, it was like basically a very culturally a white experience. And then on the south side of Chicago, going to Granny and with all the kids watch Good Times, right? And to be honest, I didn't connect, but I was so fearful and of them not thinking that I did, that even when they weren't around, I was watching Good Times. And Granny came in the room and she goes, Marina, now you know you don't want to watch Good Times. Go ahead and turn to the Brady Bunch. She's like, it's okay. But she was the first woman to really say it's all right.
I had a middle school guidance counselor who had a really huge impact on my life, and even through high school and college, she's fantastic. And she I remember in eighth grade, she nominated me for an award for like being an outstanding student. Like I was like an athlete and a good student. And she came to the banquet with me, and she just was awesome. Miss Burnett. Hey,
Miss Burnett.
It's just somebody I think of often. I haven't reached out to her in years now that I think about that, but she told me all the time. She's like, you're really smart. You're going to do something with your life. And now I'm a comedian. But I did something with my life first, Miss Burnett.
You are still doing something.
But yeah, no, she was huge.
You should find her on Facebook.
I'm going to find her now, right now. Bye, guys.
So I think this is a good place to come to a close. Unless there's anything else you want to tell our audience that we missed on or anything?
Each one, teach one. Because you never know. You might be someone's granny or you might be someone's guidance counselor. You never know. You might be someone's mom. Each one, teach one.
We do at the end of the show a Friends Like Us and then what you're doing next. So it's kind of like we changed the end of, you know, like with Friends Like Us, you don't need enemies, but we change it to like a theme of what we just talked about. So I'll go first, just sort of, yeah, I never do a there. Really good one. But so Marina Franklin here, I'm really honored and thankful that you were both here today, because even though we're comedians, we love to get into these serious topics because it's so needed today. And like I said, if I can't open a resource center in my neighborhood, this is as close as I'm going to get right now. To reach out, go to my website, marinafranklin.com, because it's easier. It'll be listed there to see where I will be. And with Friends Like Us, you can be one to teach one.
Stealing.
I changed it. I did
no,
steal it. No, I can't do that.
Come All again. Right.
Come again?
Yes.
With Friends Like Us, you can be the nanny in your neighborhood. Erin's trying to. She's trying to.
No, I just wanted to make sure you didn't steal her
Wendy on it.
No, just let her shine.
Okay, Erin, you next.
ErinJackson.net. That's me. EJ the comic. Instagram, Twitter. Find me. In the next couple weeks, I will be. Well, I don't know when this comes out. So, mid-April. I'll just say, I'll be at the Boston Comedy Festival. Nope, the Women in Comedy Festival in Boston. So I've got a bunch of dates. They're on my website, different shows. I think I'm doing like 4 or 5 shows while I'm there. And I guess Marina's going to be there too.
Yeah, I'll
She's
be there
mouthing.
Too.
Like you could talk.
I didn't want to ruin your moment.
It's fine.
She's like, I'll be there too. I'll be there.
So yeah, so that's happening. I'll be in the city around. So come see me in the city. And with Friends Like Us, you can make an impact in your community, make a difference.
That's sweet. Or you could be a granny.
Or you can watch the Brady Bunch if you want, and we'll judge you.
Right. Okay.
That's what I was going to say first, but I didn't want to clown you.
No, that was good. That was good.
You want to go next?
Okay. So, my name is Reverend Wendy. You can find us on Facebook.
Do the students call you Reverend Wendy?
Yeah, they call
me
Reverend.
I love that.
I actually tell them they can call me anything but Boba, which is dummy in Spanish. You can call me anything. So, if people don't want to call me Reverend, they can call me Wendy. That's bottom line. But I'm Reverend Wendy. You can find Bronx Connect on Facebook. We'd love it if you like us. And we have a Twitter account. I don't think we have an Instagram account because we don't have any young, dynamic folks like interns like you. Check us out. We have things coming up regularly. I don't know when this is going to come, but we have quarterly job fairs. We have events. We have opportunities to mentor different ages, different times. And we always love people who love our kids, who are willing to see the best in them. So with friends like us, you are empowered to reach one so you can teach one.
Ah.
How's that?
Nice. She added the word empowered. Woo.
This is tough.
Why, Pamela? Come on. You can do it, Pamela.
Miss Pam here.
Miss
like
Pam?
The cooking spray. Miss Pamela Viacundu. I work at Bronx Connect, which I have the honor of working alongside Reverend Wendy and Miss Tara Brown Arnell, who couldn't make it today, but does incredible work and they've been at it for many, many years and have so much wonderful experience. So I'm very grateful they could be here today. Very excited to join the organization, work with young people and with friends like us. Get involved locally, find out what's going on, not, look beyond the headlines.
You know what? I would also say, Pamela, while you were talking, what I really appreciate about you.
What's that?
Is that you came up to me and asked me to do that fundraiser because I wouldn't have known about it had you not approached. So if you're one of those people, like, go up to people and ask them to be involved, and that's what you did, and I just thank you so much. I sound so emotional, but I really it means a lot to me because she asked me, she goes, is this something you do? I know you're funny. She goes, but I don't know if this is something you do, and it's absolutely like at the heart of all of comedians. Like, this is actually what we love
for
to
real.
Do.
Because everybody, but the thing is, a lot of times there are organizations that I want to support, and financially I can't do it. But what can I do? Well, I can help you raise money, and that's something that we're always open to doing for organizations that we believe in. So
we'll make you laugh,
awesome.
Bring some comedy,
I'll
and
be in touch.
We will be in touch.
Check us out. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Yay.
Thank you.